How many of you are familiar with the call and response, God is good all the time? And how many of you know what to say when someone says he is risen? Good job. All right. Well, we are so glad that you are here to celebrate Resurrection Sunday with us. I want to start off this morning by having a little trivia. I'm going to put some phrases up, maybe not. They're not showing up, and that's okay. Don't worry about it then, right? If Jesus defeated death, we can all listen to a sermon without slides, right? Right? You really don't have a choice. So anyway, moving on. All right, so I will tell you what the slides are going to say. And you tell me if that is something, true or false, that is in the Bible or that Jesus said. So how about this one? God helps those who help themselves. Okay, not in the Bible. In fact, in Romans, it says that God helps those who are, in fact, helpless. All right, everything happens for a reason.
Baloney.
All right, baloney. Also not in the Bible. Cleanliness is next to godliness. We hope not. That is also, it sounds like it would make a good proverb, right? Be good to tell maybe our kids or maybe me. Nope, not in the Bible. All right. This one, let's see if you know this one. Money is the root of all evil. Close but no cigar, someone says. The love of money is the root of all evil. Okay, here's another one that is often thought to be in the Bible. Hate the sin, love the sinner. No. Correct, not in the Bible. All right, I got one more for you. God will never put more on you than you can bear. Also not in the Bible. Now, you may be asking, Pastor Jessica, why are you walking through these things that aren't in the Bible? They are things that Jesus never said. Because for the last 7 weeks, we've been covering some very specific things that Jesus did, in fact, say. They're called the I am statements. They're found in the Gospel of John. These I am statements were a declaration about who Jesus was, about how he was working in the world. And I've been arguing for the last 7 weeks that these statements give us statements to say about ourselves. We can say, because he is, fill in the blank, I am, then fill in the blank. Now you might wonder, why have we spent so much time on these I am statements though? Besides the application that we can walk away with, that because of who Jesus is, we can experience satisfaction and peace and security and love and hope. It is because the I am statements of Jesus are a big part of the reason that he was killed. And then give you an example. We're going to be in the Gospel of John in three different places. We're going to start in the Gospel of John, chapter 8. This was one we looked at a few weeks ago in John chapter 8 when we talked about Jesus being the light of the world. Jesus has just got done interacting with a woman who was caught in the act of adultery, and he has not condemned her. He has not insisted that she be punished, probably because he also realized that there was someone else that should have been present if we're going to carry out the law, the man, and he wasn't. He understood that this woman was being used to make a point to trap Jesus. And this causes all kinds of concerns and questions for many of the people. And they begin to argue with Jesus. He tells them, hey, I'm the light of the world, right? I'm the light by which you should see things. And they begin this conversation back and forth. And Jesus begins to call them out. And he says, listen, you talk about how much you love Abraham, but if you loved Abraham, if you really were followers of Abraham, then you would believe me. You would follow me. And they're like, seriously, seriously, who are you? Who do you think you are? We're children of Abraham. And so Jesus continues this back and forth until at some point, Jesus makes this declaration at the very end of chapter 8. He says to them, I tell you the truth, before Abraham was even born, I am. And it says at that point, they picked up stones to throw at him. But Jesus was hidden from them and he left the temple. What about the statement Jesus just made them so angry that in that moment they were willing to pick up stones and stone him? They believed that he had done something awful. He had created a blasphemy. I can't say the word. Somebody help me out. Blaspheme. This is going to be fun when we put it on the internet. Right? He had disrespected God in just about the worst way you can. So let's talk about why that statement is so significant. Jesus says, "I tell you the truth, before Abraham was even born, I am." So let's start with the phrase, "I am." To understand I am, you have to go all the way back to the Old Testament. Do you remember when the people were slaves in Egypt? How many of you saw Prince of Egypt, Disney's animated film? So even if you didn't get this, this should be somewhat familiar to you, right? They're enslaved. And God hears their cries. They can't rescue themselves. So God sends a deliverer by a guy by the name of Moses. And their initial conversation happens at this burning bush, right? There's a bush. It's on fire. It's not being consumed. Moses says, "Hey, I should go check that out." He goes over there and this conversation begins between God and Moses. And Moses is a very reluctant hero. He's really not interested in doing this. And finally, one of the reasons that he gives is, okay, what am I going to tell them when I come there? Who am I going to say sent me? Give me your name. Because how are they supposed to believe me? And so out of this bush, God declares, "I am. I am." Another way he could have said that is, "I exist. I am being." If you may have remembered a few weeks ago, we talked about in the Gospel of John, he writes that Jesus is the Word. And we said that's a Greek word for logos, which means the source of all things, the thing that emanates and governs everything, that gives all things life and intelligence and sustains things. It's so incomprehensible. That is what God is declaring to Moses, "I just am. I have no beginning, no end, no one made me. I just exist. And everything that exists will find its source in me." And so when Jesus declares that before Abraham was even born, "I am," he's telling them, "Yep, you know your history. When God spoke from the bush and declared that his name was I am, that was me. I was up in that with the Father and the Spirit." And then it gets even better. Listen to the grammar. "I tell you the truth, before Abraham was even born, I am." He doesn't say before Abraham, "I was." He is not reincarnated. He is not a prophet brought back to life to tell people about the coming kingdom. He's saying, I am eternal. I exist outside of time and space. Therefore, when Abraham was, I just am. Just like I am right now in front of you. And this was crazy talk because only God could be eternal. Only God could exist out of time and space and be present in the present tense in all times and in all spaces throughout history. And so, this is why they wanted to kill Jesus, because he made the claims that "I am God." And the proof that everything that he has said about who he is being true is bound up in the resurrection. That's why the resurrection matters so much. Everything we believe hinges on the resurrection, because if he can raise himself from the dead, then the only option is he must be God. And everything that he has said is also true. There had been prophets that had come before that had done miracles, said amazing things, had even raised people from the dead. But no one had ever been able to raise themselves from the dead. Only God could. Now, as we've been walking through these I am's, I discovered something that I had never seen before that I think is a foreshadowing of what happens on Resurrection Sunday. And it begins in John in just the first four chapters. Jesus has just started his ministry. He's out there in John chapter 4, and he travels through Samaria. And he wants a drink of water, and so he stops at a well, and his disciples go on into town. They're going to try to get some food. It's the afternoon, and along comes a woman by herself to get water. Now, this is odd, because most of the women and children that would have come to get water came at the same time. This was a community activity. This is where you found out how Sister Susie was doing, right? And who was sick, and who needed help, and who needed an extra meal. Who needed their flowers tended to, their garden, their wine press, and I'll send my kid over to help. So it was odd that this woman was coming, not with the other women. It told us something that we don't necessarily know yet what about her. That she has in some way or form been ostracized from her community. And Jesus speaks to her, and she is shaken. And there's lots of reasons for this. First of all, he's a man and she's a woman. In this time, and even in still many places, there are a lot of social protocols for what should happen when men and women are in the same space. And in this time, men and women did generally not speak to one another without someone of their own sex being present. Let alone touch, let alone engage in any kind of intimate personal conversation. And so here is this man beginning to speak to her. Add on top of that, he's a Jew and she's a Samaritan. There was this long, ancient history between the Jews and the Samaritans. Samaritans were considered half-breeds. It goes all the way back when the Israelites were taken into exile. And they had huge differences of religious beliefs about who God was, where the temple should be, how they should sacrifice. They had huge, strong differences between what it meant to be God's people and what that meant for their nation. And it would often spill out into blood being shed between these two people groups. Many of the Jews would avoid walking through Samaria because, as you can imagine, there would be tensions. And so you'd want to avoid those tensions. Some avoided it because they thought themselves too good and too holy and would not want to make themselves unclean by walking through that part of the country. And so there's just layer upon layer here. And Jesus begins talking to her about the actual physical water, and then about their history together, and then about how he has something like eternal water. Something better than the actual physical water that she's come to draw. And they begin to have a discussion about worship and where should you worship. And Jesus goes on to tell her, you should go get your husband. And she says, well, I don't have one. And he says, yep, that's right. And he then reveals that she not only doesn't have a husband, but she's had five husbands. And the man that she's married to, the man she's living with, she's not even married to. Now, I just want to press pause here because we often go, oh my gosh, five husbands, okay? But we don't know the history here. Now, chances are, because she's ostracized, they weren't all widows. She had not had all five husbands die. Though if all five husbands died, people might not want to be around her. They might have some questions. But chances are, some of those were widows, had died, and she was a widow. Some of them were divorced. And it sounds awful that she's living with a man that she's not married to. But again, consider her options. She can go beg on the street, or she could go be a prostitute. One of those is probably a better moral choice than being a prostitute, right? So like, you know, you pick your sin. So like, this is a whole situation that isn't that simple. And Jesus doesn't call her out on this to humiliate her or say, oh, you sinner. But he wants to show her who he is. By revealing this intimate bit of information, she recognizes, oh my goodness, okay, you're a prophet. And they continue their conversation. By seeing her, he has drawn her in. And as they're talking, the woman says, I know that the Messiah is coming, the one who has called Christ. When he comes, he will explain everything to us. And it seems like you've got this two people, two different backgrounds, kind of having this discussion. They don't necessarily agree. And her focus is, you know what, when the Messiah comes, when the anointed one, when the one that God is sending that will restore all things and redeem Israel, we'll understand. she's got the right focus on. And Jesus speaks to her and tells her the first I am. He says in John chapter 4, verses 25 and 26, I am the Messiah. What an odd person for Jesus to reveal for the first time who he is to. This would not be who you would think he would choose. And yet this is who he has chosen to begin to reveal who he is to. And what I see in the story is that she was seen for who she was. Good, bad, life experiences, she was seen. Jesus engaged in a respectful and dignifying conversation with her, even while he knows all this other crud. She is seen. And her response, when he declares that she is the Messiah, she goes running because she is shocked. She runs back to town and she says, come with me. You have got to see the man who told me everything I did. Maybe he's the Messiah. This woman who has come to the well alone, away from everybody else, maybe by her own choice because she doesn't want to listen to all the snotty ladies. Doesn't seem to care anymore what the ladies have to say. Books her butt straight in town to declare what she has seen and experienced. Something has changed within her, all because she was seen. And because she was seen and changed, the only option it seemed for her to do was to go and to share her experiences. And as I thought about Resurrection Sunday, I thought, man, that reminds me of Mary. John chapter 20. It tells us that while it was still dark on Sunday morning, Mary Magdalene came to the tomb. And she found that the stone had been rolled away from the entrance. She runs and gets the disciples. They come back. They see that it is in fact true. They go on, they're trying to figure out what has happened, where's his body. And it says in verse 11 that Mary is standing outside the tomb crying. And as she's weeping, she stoops and she looks again. She sees angels and they tell her, no one's taken the body. He's not here. And then it tells us that she turned to leave. And someone asked her, why are you crying? And she doesn't recognize him. You think about that. She spent 3 years with Jesus. She doesn't recognize him. Because her grief is so profound in that moment. She's so distraught and confused and trying to make sense of what has happened. And this friend that she's lost and all her hopes and her dreams. And then where's the body? She does not recognize him. And she's this person that she thinks is the gardener says, well, who are you looking for? And she turns, she says to the gardener, if you've taken him away, tell me, where have you put him? And I'll go get him. You don't have to do the work. I'll go get him. And then Jesus says, Mary. He says her name and she cries out, Rabboni. Rabbi. How in the world, on one hand, did Mary not recognize him? And how in the world did her eyes become open to see him simply by him saying her name? She knew what her name sounded like on his lips. Because for 3 years, she has followed him. For 3 years, Jesus has seen her. And I want to clarify a little bit of a misnomer about Mary Magdalene. She was demon-possessed, not a prostitute. Jesus saw her background, saw where she came from, and he delivered her. And their relationship was such that when he said her name, she knew there was only one person that said it like that. And it was Jesus. Her life had been so changed by her time with Jesus. And her response is to do exactly what Jesus tells her to do. He says, go, tell your brothers and sisters, my brothers and sisters, where I am and where I'm going. And that is exactly what Mary Magdalene does. She goes and she finds the disciples, and she has said, I have seen the Lord. These women were made new because they had been with Jesus. They were made new because they had an experience with Jesus. And because Jesus is not dead, the same is true for you and I. We are also seen. We are also made new. We are also changed and transformed. For some of us, we talked about this last week, it will be like that woman at the well, a sudden moment where your eyes are opened and you're like, oh my goodness, I think this is the Messiah. And for others, you will become to know the sound of his voice like Mary, spending day in and day out, going where he goes, doing what he does, and following him. And it's crazy to me to think that at the front of his ministry and at the end of his ministry, the first people to hear that I am the Messiah, and yes, I am in fact alive, are women. And not to make this a feminist sermon, but I don't want you to lose sight of that. Did you know that a woman could not testify because she wasn't considered well enough, good enough, smart enough, I don't know, to be a witness? She was automatically not counted as reliable. And yet Jesus says, oh, that's who I'm going to pick. That's who I'm going to choose to declare first to the town of Samaritan, to the very people that we, my people, think aren't worthy enough. And Mary, you're going to go tell the men, the very men that I'm going to set up to lead the early church. They're going to hear it from you first. And this made me think of Paul's writing in 1 Corinthians chapter 5. He talks about how we are ambassadors for Christ. That it is our job because we have been seen by God, because we have been changed by Jesus. It is then our responsibility to go and to share and to tell others about the good news of Jesus Christ. And he says in verse 16 of 2 Corinthians chapter 5, we have stopped evaluating others from a human point of view. At one time, we thought of Christ merely from a human point of view, but how differently we know him now. And this means that anyone who belongs to Christ has become a new person. The old life is gone, and a new life has begun. Paul ties up together this idea of transformation, of a newness in our life, spilling out in the way we view others. And so what I want to declare to you this morning is not only is Jesus risen, but he sees you. He desires to make you new. And he calls you to go and tell other people about the love and the sacrifice of that he did on the cross for us, and that he is not dead anymore. Most of us, I'm going to make some assumptions. Probably, I'm sorry that this keeps doing the thing, would say that we know Jesus. But I've grown up in church all my life, and I can tell you exactly what it's supposed to look like. And that don't mean anything. And so I want to not pass Easter without giving an invitation. If you are someone who says, I have never chosen to follow Christ. I've never actually got it. But I recognize that I'm not perfect. And I can never be perfect. I recognize that even in my word to get it right, I just have limitations because I am not the I am. I do not just exist. So I also need not only a savior, but a friend and a companion, someone to guide me. And I want to make that choice. It's real simple. That's it. I make the choice. I declare it. Or maybe you're someone who says, you know, I kind of been spending time with Jesus. Huh. But I don't know that I've ever declared it. There's an opportunity here to declare it. And there's lots of ways to do it. You can do it sitting in your seat. I don't have to know. But I'm going to challenge you, if that would be you, as we sing the song, our next song, I'm going to invite you during the first verse, and it's awkward, and I hate doing awkward. I hate doing awkward. But I'm going to invite you to literally stand in your seat. If you want to say for the first time, or if you want to say, I have been following, but I've never declared that, to stand where you are. And you may say, well, what are people going to think? You know what? If anybody gives you the side eye, I'll take them out, okay? Because we have all made the declaration that we are not enough on our own, and we kind of need Jesus. And you're not going to be standing on your own very long, because, of course, we're all going to stand and continue to worship. And so you're invited to do that. And I just, again, want to invite you. This place is always an altar. You can come and sit in the front row. You can come and stand. You never have to, but it is always welcome to come. If you just want to stand here and say, I want to celebrate the fact that Jesus sees me, that he's changed me, and sometimes it's been, ooh, the light finally came on, dur-dur-dur. And other times, I'm stubborn as all get out, and it has taken me forever. But slowly, he's made me new. And you just want to come up here and say, thank you, Jesus, that this space is always open. Will you pray with me? Jesus, we thank you. I thank you that you didn't just come at 33, spend a few weeks here, die on a cross and rise again. You actually came and spent life here. Like, you get what all of this feels like. A tired body, annoying friends, the highs and the lows that come with life. You've lost people you loved, and you had people betray you, and you saw amazing things happen. And you showed us how to live as a human in partnership with the Father. And so I thank you for the life that you lived. And I thank you that when evil turned on you, when we who thought we were good turned to you because you said things that we didn't like, that made us uncomfortable, you didn't act like the God we wanted. And so we turned on you, as we humans so quickly do. That you did not return in violence. You did not call down hell, fire, and brimstone. But you said, I'll take it, because I need you to know that I love you and I see you. And I came so that you might be changed. And so I just thank you for that. And so as we celebrate that you are alive, may we open our hearts and fully experience that. And may we leave here changed, continuing to be changed, and may we tell other people that the God of the universe, the being that just is being, sees them, loves them, and is committed to them. Amen.